Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's Tuesday, April 30th. And I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2622A. Sandy, bring us up to date here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 2622A makes some modification and changes to the definition of physician to include podiatrist in the definition of a physician in statute. The A2s reformat it so that it's all in one statement rather than subsections. The A3 amendments, you may recall, are conflict amendments between 2622 and House Bill 2684. We need to adopt, the committee, if they so choose, needs to adopt both amendments, and there are no fiscal and minimal impact on both amendments.
Okay. We are in work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments be incorporated into House Bill 2622A2.
Okay, so Senator Steiner Hayward moves the dash A2 amendments into House Bill 2622. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A3 amendments into House Bill 2622.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves the dash A3 amendments into House Bill 2622. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2622A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves House Bill 2622A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call a roll.
Senator
Hayward? Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Senator Cruz?
Excused.
Chairman?
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll have Senator Cruz carry this bill. Unless Senator Knope, would you like to carry this bill?
I think Senator Cruz is a good carrier.
Okay. Right. So Senator Cruz will carry this bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2622. And now I'd like to open an informational hearing on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act compliance. And we'll have Sean and Barney Spate and Laura Callie. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office. Thanks for taking the time today out of your busy calendar to hear a little bit about the Affordable Care Act and what we're doing to implement it the way Oregon needs to make it work for us. I'm here just as the intro, and I unfortunately have to leave after my part is done, but I'll leave you in the capable hands of Barney and Laura to talk about the effects in the commercial market and moving forward. So this is really to kick off sort of a two-day trek for you. In your next hearing, we'll hear from Bruce and sort of the impacts on the Medicaid program and the health authority. So feel free to ask questions as we go, but we'll just sort of kick us off here. So just sort of as a refresher, I mean, there's been a lot of debate about the Affordable Care Act, and the Supreme Court sort of affirmed what it is. And so now that we know it's the law of the land, I think it's now our obligation to implement it as effectively as we can in Oregon to make sure that it works for Oregonians. It really does sort of three things generally, and we're going to focus only sort of on one piece. It has some population health reforms in it, a lot of funding for public health programs, et cetera, some delivery system reform, so think about your accountable care organizations in the Medicare program. But really what we're going to talk about over the next 2 days is sort of coverage and access come 2014. Come January 1, 2014, we're really going to have a new world in terms of access to coverage, both in the Medicaid program and in the health insurance community, both through the individual market as well as through the health insurance exchange. And that's what we'll focus mostly on today. So just as sort of some context first around Medicaid. So as you recall, we have a lot of eligibility categories for Medicaid. So you have to have blonde hair, blue eyes, have a certain income with certain assets. The Affordable Care Act essentially wipes a lot of that away and basically says if you're poor, you're eligible for Medicaid. So if you're under 138% of poverty, so that's $15,000 for a single adult, you're eligible for Medicaid. And as part of the Medicaid expansion conversation that the governor hopes the legislature will pass and is built into his budget, the feds will pay for that expansion for the first 3 years at 100%. And then it sort of tapers down, as you see, to a 90-10 match. Just to sort of give you a little bit of perspective, so our sort of normal match is somewhere in the 67% range. So this is a huge federal investment in Oregon to allow us to expand Medicaid. What that means from a real people perspective is about 180,000 Oregonians, we project, in this biennium will be eligible for the Medicaid expansion over the next 2 years, with sort of the outlying number of about 220,000 Oregonians that currently don't have coverage that will now get coverage through a Medicaid expansion. Then, as Barney and Laura will talk more about in much more detail, there is quite a bit of new regulation and new policy around the insurance market and the regulated insurance market. So I know everyone's read about guaranteed issue and no pre-existing conditions. That's sort of a big one. But there's all kinds of other things like lifetime limits, allows certain lifetime limits until 2014, eliminating waiting periods, a lot of consumer protection aspects in the commercial market. So how do we then align with what the ACA is saying we have to do, will be law of the land, and how we implement that with what we currently have in Oregon law. And then it also has a reinsurance program federally that Barney and Laura will talk a little bit about in more detail. But these are some of the things in sort of the commercial market, again, for the individual and small group market in Oregon.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
We're hearing rumors from D.C. that some of the deadlines may be being backed off as far as what HHS is. I mean, and your previous slide had these 2014, and we're hearing rumors that there's a lot of pressure to back them off even further. Are you hearing much about that at this point?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, there's a lot of pressure from a lot of places to D.C. to try to figure out how to be more flexible. We haven't gotten any affirmative action from the feds about whether they're moving dates or not.
Okay.
If you have a specific issue, we can talk to you sort of offline, but
It's kind of a general flavor what I'm hearing from members of Congress, or what I'm reading from members of Congress, that maybe we need to.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, for the record, Barney Spate with the Health Authority. The one area that we do know that, at least in the federal implementation of the program, is that the federal exchanges that would be operational in the states that Right. do not bring their own state-run exchanges up, there's been a decision made that the small group, or the what's known as the SHOP exchange, will not be implemented in 2014 in those states that are using the federal exchange model. So that's one area. That's primarily, I think, an issue. It's a highly technical area. From the point of view, and I can't speak for Cover Oregon, from the point of view of the Oregon Exchange and everything that we know as of today, we're still, as a state, moving forward with 2014 implementation in both the individual and the small group market.
Okay. Thank you.
So I think one of the things that sort of sets Oregon apart from other states, and Senator Cruz, you sort of led us up to this, is this isn't just about sort of access and coverage. That's an important piece, and the Affordable Care Act actually lets us do a lot of those things. But it's really about thinking about how we redesign the delivery system to be sustainable long term. You all have been very engaged in the CCO work in Medicaid over the last 2 years or so, but we've been on this path as a state for quite a while. So how do we then use the opportunities within the Affordable Care Act to really implement Oregon reform that works for Oregon and, again, creates a sustainable delivery system that actually meets the triple aim of better care, better health at lower cost, and doesn't just cover people in a system that is unsustainable. So one of the things that the governor has been really pointed on over the last 6 to 12 months, and one of the reasons that Barney's here, is we really needed to make sure that we had sort of an all-agency hands-on as we were implementing the ACA, because it touches a host of agencies. It touches the health authority through its Medicaid work and other programs, eligibility, et cetera. It touches the insurance division, DCBS, obviously, with some of the market regulation. It touches Cover Oregon, the health insurance exchange, and it touches some decisions that the governor's office needs to have. So how do we have, making sure that we have alignment and coordination between all four of these groups to make sure we're implementing things right and we're not making decisions in silos? Because there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen come 2014, and we need to make sure we're being thoughtful about not only the decisions we're making for tomorrow, but the decisions we're making for a year or 2 years from now, and making sure we can adjust as we go. Senator Cruz?
Yes. Okay, you know, we haven't bundled all Medicaid funding into one little thing yet. There's still some that goes through Department of Ed, still some that goes through Department of Human Services. So how does this all roll in? Because there's connections there as well.
Correct. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, so it connects with what we're doing on the Medicaid side in terms of CCOs. There's an implementation plan of moving the 45-plus funding streams for Medicaid that run through the health authority through the CCO global budgets. And as you know, some of those conversations happened very quickly, and rightfully so, and others, like non-emergent transportation, are going to take a little while for folks to get their feet under them to understand what those implications of those dollars are.
So at this point in time, one could assume, for example, and I know it's a small piece of Medicaid that is through the schools and things like that. They're kind of static until something bigger is figured out.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, what funding are you referring to that's going through the schools from Medicaid?
Yeah.
And we can follow up with you later. That's okay.
Okay,
we'll follow up.
We'll talk off.
Okay.
I guess I just add, because you missed the first part, Senator. Tomorrow, Bruce will be here talking about the Medicaid, the two bills that relate to Medicaid reform, and some of the questions that you might have, Medicaid specific, you'll have a more informed audience. With all due respect to my colleague to the right.
Madam Chair, that's fine, but I, you know, there's so many strands of Medicaid.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. So, again, this has sort of been our frame and our collective frame around how we're dealing with sort of the traditional budgeting mechanism and making sure that as we make decisions around implementation, around reform, we have these sort of pieces in mind and we move away from just sort of the traditional ways we do things and really think about how we move the delivery system to be more sustainable long-term. Again, not just looking at the short-term view, but the long-term view of how we're implementing and how it's going to work for Oregonians. So these are sort of the five principles as we sort of look at delivery system reform and reform in Oregon and how we go from this is being implemented within CCOs and Medicaid, but as we look forward, Medicaid's only 16% of the state population. Yes, that will grow if the legislature approves the Medicaid expansion, but even with that, it might not be enough in some communities to actually drive delivery system change. So how do we do that? How do we move from just being about Medicaid to being about the care that we're all receiving? So how do we move this kind of framework into PEB, speaking as the chair of Public Employees Benefit Board, into OEB, another purchasing pool that the state has control over, and then how do we align with private business and community partners to really show the delivery system what the next model is going to be so we're all essentially purchasing towards the same ends, not necessarily through a CCO, but really signaling to the delivery system, this is where we're all going to go, this is what we expect when we buy, and they can start seeing their new business model to start making the kinds of changes that we all want them to make. So that's sort of the 2.0 work that I think as we implement the ACA and move forward to think about how we move the work that we've already been doing over the last couple of years and most recently with CCOs forward to make a delivery system that's sustainable for all of us.
You having conversations with the ERISA folks as well? I mean the self-insureds?
Chairman Sanders, Senator Cruz, yes.
Okay.
So with that, if there's not any more questions for me, I will pass the mic over to Barney and Laura and leave you in their capable hands. And if you have any questions, you know where to get me.
You bet. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
Good afternoon. For the record again, Madam Chair, my name is Barney Spate. I'm a special assistant to the director of the Health Authority and have been working with Mike and Sean and the governor's office on implementation of ACA. And with me today.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Laura Calley, and I'm the chief actuary and the manager of product regulation for the insurance division.
The purpose of our presentation today is to give you a very high level, and I would like to say kind of objective, value neutral perspective on the implementation of ACA, with particular reference to the impact in the individual and small group markets. I'm going to start with a relatively, really brief background on the current individual market. Okay, too loud. Okay. So you can get a sense of context of how the individual market reforms in part came about and also what their intent at least is to address. Some of the implications and mitigation initiatives that that are being worked on, including proposed legislation in this session, and then I'll wrap up with some comments on the ACA reforms in the small group market. Laura is here to assist me on a good part of this if there are questions that relate that need her actuarial technical expertise, and she will give the summary when we get into the two pieces of legislation that are pending in the legislative session. And I'd urge you to ask questions as we go along if you have any. So
we're not shy, Barney.
It's been a while, Senator, but I do recall that you're not shy, and I urge you not to be. The current individual market is really characterized by 5 points on this slide and the following slide. One, there's medical underwriting. What that means in Oregon is that a carrier that is in the individual market receives an application for somebody that wants to buy coverage in the individual market, and they have the right to review a medical statement that the applicant supplies and to either accept the person for coverage or to reject them for coverage. The services can vary. That is, the types of benefits that are included can vary between carriers. Some have prescription drug coverage, some do not. Some have mental health coverage or limited mental health coverage. Some have other, they're very, what I'm getting at is that the level of coverage can vary between carriers. There's a wide choice of cost-sharing options, deductibles, co-insurance, and out-of-pocket max. The current individual market represents approximately 10% of the private health insurance market in this state. And in Oregon, we are characterized as having a very competitive market. With 7 domestic carriers that insure about 85% of the individual market, and listed there are those 7 carriers in alphabetical order. And we're anticipating that the 2014 reforms and the work that Laura and her staff will be undertaking.
Yes, Senator Hayward.
Just out of curiosity, I should know the answer to this, but if you could tell me, you've got them in alphabetical order. What are they in order of market share?
Roughly, Regents has the highest market share. I know that ODS has the third. I believe Kaiser has the second. And I can't speak, but I can get this information to you.
I'd be grateful with roughly the number of covered lives, if that's possible.
Yeah.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you very much.
I know what I've done. Okay. So, again, this is one statistic I pulled together to get for regarding medical underwriting and rejections. The rejections in the individual market have to be reported to the insurance division on a quarterly basis. And looking back at 2012, you can see that roughly 80,000 persons applied for coverage in the individual market, and approximately, this is an industry average, 21% were rejected for coverage for a pre-existing condition of some form.
And that goes away, correct?
That goes away.
Yes. All right.
And now I would note also that 21%, I pointed out, an industry average. There are carriers that have a higher rejection rate, and there are also carriers that have a lower rejection rate.
And just this particular stat, what impact, what percentage of increase in premiums that we're going to see coming down the line will this have?
Let me get deeper into my presentation and see if and I can I, begin to give you some at least general information about that.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, you may be about to get to this, but let me ask a couple of questions about this. The first is, do we have any sense of how many of those almost 17,000 people ended up in OMIP?
I do not, but I have an OMIP slide here.
Okay.
To talk about OMIP.
All right.
Okay.
And then the second is, when you send us, you mentioned that different carriers have different rejection rates. When you send us those data about the covered lives, could you also send us data about the numbers of applications rejected by each of those carriers? Because the numbers of applications they received are, in each quarter at least, are really, you know, I just like to see, like, how many applications
they got.
We can
take the last quarter, or we can take the average. Yeah, we can get both of those.
Whatever is plausible. Yeah. I mean, okay. Of course, sum them up over the whole year or whatever is easy for you to do. But I'd like to get some sense of what different carriers are doing.
Can do.
Thank you very much.
And you raise your line of questioning poses a good segue, is that those who are rejected in the individual market for any of the coverages do have an option in Oregon to enroll in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, a program that we've had in the state for several decades. Indicated here is that in January of 2013, we have a little over 11,000 members in OMIP. At one point in time, OMIP had about 17,000 members. Give you just a sense of the demographic of OMIP, almost 70% are over the age of 45, 59% are female, 61% are under the age, have incomes, reported incomes of under 45,000. When you are in OMIP, you have the choice of three plans. The 750, 1,000, and 1,500 are basically codes for deductibles. With one TPA, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield is the administrator of the OMIP program. They are not at risk for the program. And as you would expect from a high-risk pool, the next bullet points out that their loss ratio is 199%. With expenses, this is a recent month of about 1,434 with premium income of about 605. So the first question for a neophyte would be, well, how do you make up the $800? The $800 is made up, has been made up through assessments on the insured community in Oregon. In 2012, the annual assessment was about a little over $89 million, or about $5.09 per member per month, PMPM. And that assessment was on all insured groups and all insured individuals and on reinsurers who self-insured employers. But it's not an assessment on the self-insured employers themselves because of ERISA issues. So OMIP, and I would point out that while OMIP will in fact go away with the elimination of medical underwriting, I think all of us, and many of you have been involved with OMIP over the years, can be proud that the role that OMIP has played in this state to make our individual market fairer from a kind of a proportional point of view relative to both the size of Oregon and the size of our individual market generally. We've had a very successful and thriving reinsurance program, primarily because I think the financing mechanism for this has been accepted by those who pay the assessment.
And when does that assessment go away?
It will end December 31 of 2013.
Okay.
Now, the OMIP staff will be administering the phase-out of the program because they will have to pay for claims for those three benefit designs into 2014. But the actual enrollment of OMIP will go to the exchange beginning in October. They will have choices, and we'll get into a little bit of the kind of choices that they have.
Okay.
Okay. So let's look at what ACA does to the individual market. The The first and most profound change is guaranteed issue and guaranteed renewability. That is the elimination of medical underwriting. For those of you who recall the Oregon Health Fund Board, and I was the executive director at the time, we looked, Oregon was among a few states that looked really hard at how do you reform your individual market, specifically looking at the issues of medical underwriting. And there was really kind of a simple equation that I developed that if you don't want medical underwriting and you want guaranteed issue, then you have to have a mandate. And you have to have a mandate because of the issues of what is known adverse selection or moral hazard. And if you have a mandate, then you really need to have some sort of funding mechanism for those who want to abide by the law but may not necessarily be able to afford the minimum coverage that's in place. And if you have such a funding mechanism, you need a revenue stream. So we were pretty well versed, I think, from a policy perspective, both in the executive branch but in the legislative branch from that kind of work from 2009. So the other side of the guaranteed issue and renewability is, in fact, the individual mandate. And later in my presentation, I will get into some of the exceptions and penalties and how that mandate operates. The other aspect, if you recall, I said that there's wide variation in the type of coverage that can be bought. The ACA requires an essential health benefit package. It standardizes, if you will, the benefits that are covered, what services are covered across 10 categories of coverage, and those are listed here. Now, there is some flexibility within those coverages, but you'll notice, for example, that mental health, substance disorders, substance use disorders, and prescription drugs are all part of, if you will, that mandate for the answering the question, what's covered.
Barney, how does that differ from what's required in Medicaid currently?
It's not as fully comprehensive as Medicaid, okay, but it is more comprehensive than the commercial market is right now. That would be my general. We can get you line by line. I believe there are services covered in Medicaid that may not be required through the EHBs. Does that help?
It helps. I'm just trying to figure out how this benefit plan aligns with Medicaid, or does Medicaid align with it, or do they stay separate?
Well, I would characterize them as being, if you're thinking about this commercial market aligning with the Medicaid, I would say that they're much more aligned in answering the question what's covered. For example, earlier I indicated there's a fair degree of variation in mental health coverage. Mm-hmm. in the individual market. There are in fact, it's permissible, and people do. They buy individual policies without prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. So those are two areas of where bringing the individual market brings it much closer in line with. But there may be because Medicaid is targeted at a very low income population, there may be some additional services in Medicaid that are not covered in EHB, and we can probably get you some. And one that comes to mind right away, just because of the nature of the populations, is translation services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. In addition, then, to the answering of having
so
a much
the essential benefit package does not have translation.
No, it does not.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
In addition to, if you think of this, what's covered has been answered through or been addressed through the essential health benefit package, then how it's covered or how much one pays for what's covered is standardized across now what is in American healthcare jargon the three metallic levels of bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And what those, excuse me, four, and actually there's five, there's a catastrophic, but you're right, thank you for that correction. And what those are intended to do, this is a layman's description, is to lump or aggregate coverages that are similar in their actuarial value. An actuarial value, let's just take the bronze, which is the actual that is required by federal statute to have an actuarial value that it will, on average, cover 60% of the expected costs for the individual. Which means that on average, a person with a bronze level coverage, or people who have products today with 60% actuarial value, because all products in the market have an actuarial value, and you can buy a 60% actuarial value. In fact, you can, some products in the individual market, there are some as low as in the 40% actuarial value. But the point being on the 60 is 60% on average would be paid by the company if you use the full covered benefits of the policy you have, and 40% would be borne by the individual. And that 40% makes up basically deductibles, coinsurance, and copays. And most all policies have what is known as an out-of-pocket maximum, so after a certain threshold, 100% policy. So you can see that the bronze is in this tiering of metallics, it has the most out-of-pocket responsibility for the individual. And then as you move up to silver at 70, gold at 80, and platinum at 90, it means that more out-of-pocket, more of those costs are borne by the company that's insuring them, and less is borne by the individual. So intuitively, even an average layman like me can reach the conclusion that I bet the platinum coverage costs more than the bronze coverage. and that in fact, will be the case. The important point from a policy point of view and a market point of view is, Rocky King and others from Cover Oregon can get into greater detail, but from a consumer's point of view, shopping for an individual product, these plans now will be, if you will, be lumped or categorized by these four areas of bronze, silver, gold, and platinum, which will help a person, first of all, decide how much coverage can I afford or I want, and be able to look at an array of coverages that are all similar in their actuarial value. And so it will help the consumer understand exactly what they're buying.
Barney, you mentioned a non-metal level, which is catastrophic. Does that mean the exchange will have an offering, for example, of pure catastrophic with an HSA component?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there will be products available in the individual market that have HSA connections. I have a slide here on catastrophic that shows a little bit about catastrophic.
Okay.
So in addition, if we think of this as the ACA brings standardization to the individual market, there are maximum cost-sharing standards that the maximum out-of-pocket cost-sharing for 2014, these were estimates I put together, it's about $6,350 for an individual or $12,700 for a family. Again, that out-of-pocket would be total deductibles, copays, and coinsurance. So it sets, if you will, a national ceiling on maximum cost-sharing. Probably, and Laura is the real expert in this, but in addition to those changes in benefits and how and coverages, the real area of change that's come about with ACA is our rating reforms. And in many cases, Oregon is positioned, because of our past and because of the nature of our market today, we're in a different position than some other states. But I want to go through these because these have impact on costs and also on kind of the equity of how the market will run relative to making sure that carriers are managing their risks in a similar manner. The first is to make certain that there's a single risk pool, so that a carrier does not have to offer plans through the exchange. They can offer individual coverage through the traditional market of going directly through an agent broker or going to a website or calling the plan and buying coverage. The reason that the exchange will be a powerful mechanism, however, is because if a purchaser wants the tax credits to help them with premium, they have to buy those through the exchange. So most, I would characterize, we're expecting that most carriers that are in the individual market will be in the exchange, but they will probably also be outside the exchange. If they're in that situation, they have to have a single risk pool so that there can be no kind of actuarial or risk games about you put your healthier folks in a different pool than you put folks that may not be as healthy. That similar single risk pool, I'll show you, applies to the small group market. Then the ACA sets standards for modified community rating, is that once a carrier and Laura's staff review and approve a rate for kind of an average rate, those rates can be changed only based on family size, which we have now, one party, two party, et cetera. Geography, which we have in Oregon, we have seven. We have seven geographic areas that have been defined by the insurance division historically. Those will remain in place. So a carrier can actually modify or adjust premium based upon the cost of that coverage in different geographic areas. Now, not every carrier in Oregon uses geographic rating. I think there are two presently that do, two or three, I don't know. But that is allowable. It's basically to recognize there may be parts of the state where it's more expensive through contracts, et cetera, for coverage. Age. In the individual market, of course, those of us like me who are older use more health care from an actuarial point of view than young folks like her. And so age is the cost of coverage can vary by age. The big change that ACA put into place, though, is that there can be no greater variation in the premium you charge your youngest. Let's say it's 21. Or is it 20?
It's 21.
21, okay. Can be the oldest in your pool cannot be charged more than three times the rate that you charge your youngest. Now, Laura can address questions here and may have really meaningful addition. Currently, there is no maximum or there is no requirement for age rating as far as they have to be actuarially sound. But the natural rate is someplace over five to one. But carriers, and in some cases, we think in other states, those age bands may even be more. So you can get the and I'll show another slide in a few minutes. The issue of moving to 3 to 1 will have an impact on the cost of coverage based upon your age. And what it will tend to do, it will raise the price of coverage for those that are younger, and it will suppress some of the cost of coverage for those who are older, who may be now in a 5 to 1 or 4.8 to 1 going to 3 to 1. On the average cost of coverage, it doesn't change anything, but for the individual, it will have impact. And let me stop there and have Laura add in.
The ACA requires the 3 to 1 compression then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we had it at 5 to 1?
Well, we didn't have a formal statutory,
okay,
you have to be at this rate, but I would say while carriers had flexibility to pick those, they had to be actuarially justified based upon their experience. Is that correct?
That's correct. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. So what Barney said before is completely accurate, that the average in both our small group and our individual market, small group's a little different, and I know Barney will get there in a minute, but was about 5 to 1, and that's just kind of the natural average, but some carriers are higher than that, and significantly so. Some are closer to the 3 to 1, so there may be less of an impact due to the age rating restrictions for their existing membership, for example. But there's pretty wide variation, and it really has to do with how carriers make decisions about how they want to kind of subsidize the rates across the age bands.
I'm, of course, worried about what the cost is going to be after. I mean, today is the deadline for submission of
the rates for review.
Yes, for review.
And approval.
Oh, approval?
Yeah, they have to be reviewed in through a public, private, and public process, and then approved. And they can be rejected. They can be accepted. They can be changed.
Okay. I just get really nervous to see what that number
I think we all are, and I would point out, and there's a little bit when I do a couple of slides on the Wakely report that gave us all some insight of what was going to happen. I would point out that generally speaking, you won't see this compression factor. It's going to be difficult when people say, well, what's this mean to me? Well, we can tell you what you're hearing today. I can tell you, and Laura can tell you, generally speaking, what's going to happen. What are the cost drivers that are going to change cost? What happens at the individual level for somebody that has coverage today is going to be partly a function of which carrier do they have, what kind of age, technical age rating are they using now, and what will they be in the future? Because in some carriers, we know that some are maybe less than 4. The impact of an individual in that carrier is going to be different than the impact if they want to stay with the same carrier. So it's very difficult at the individual level to be able to say precisely this is what it's going to be. But we do know that for the young, there's going to be an impact because of this move to 3-to-1 in many segments of the market. Now, I'm going to get into subsidies through tax credits, which do have an ameliorating impact for particularly lower-income younger people.
Okay.
And I have some slides on that.
Yeah. Senator Steiner Hayward and then Senator Cruz.
You may be about to get to this. You know, one of the concerns, obviously, is that premium rates are going to go up because of the inclusion of the OMIP pool and a bunch of people where there's a whole bunch of unmet need because people have been without insurance for a long period of time. There's probably going to be some offset because a certain number of people without insurance are a young, healthy population, but it's a little hard to calculate the percentages on that. Is it a reasonable assumption or guesstimate that we'll probably see rates go up for the 14-year, probably stay moderately high for the 15-year, and then start to see some tail off once we start to meet some of the unmet need for the 16 and then certainly for the 17-year? You think that's a plausible estimate?
I'll give a policy argument, and Laura can give an argument from her professional perspective. I think relative to unmet need drivers of cost, it is plausible to expect that there would be, and we found this in the experience of expanding the Medicaid program into the standard population, is that generally, and particularly with people of lower incomes, there is oftentimes unmet need. That should, in fact, be leveled out. I would say that the cost of the populations that have been excluded from the individual market in the past because of medical underwriting, those costs will be in the market forever.
But if I may, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. So let me just clarify, right. Senator. The cost of an OMIP person, if they have high risk and high health care needs, they're paying, that's within that 199% loss ratio. The cost of that person now will be in the pool, and some of the mitigating things you'll hear about will help change the slope of how quickly those costs are actually borne by the whole pool. But I would say that because we have the OMIP population is outside that pool and persons who have not applied for insurance or have higher morbidity, those costs will, in fact, I think, be borne by the new individual market.
So two things then. The first is, I would agree about the historical experience with the OHP standard population, but it seems to me that that did level out after a couple of years of getting people on when there wasn't too much churn. And we've gone through periods where there's been a lot of churn through OHP, and that makes it hard. You get people on, you just start to get them right. Squared away, mm-hmm. Then they go back off again, and then the process repeats. But as we expand the pool in the exchange, as we're able to offer entrance into the exchange for larger employment groups, that will, in theory, spread the risk associated with the OMIP population across a larger number of covered lives.
Let me clarify. The small group will be in a separate pool than the individual group. But where you are correct, and this I think Laura's ready to jump on this, if we can get young, healthy people into the individual pool because of the mandate, so that the young healthy are in paying premium but not using health care differently than the sick, then there would be some further mitigation of the cost of the, quote, new pool because of the OMIP. So the important part from a policy point of view that we're all going to watch is what happens to the existing small group pools relative to people who have coverage, and does the new coverage and the mandate and all that will go, with selling that, bring young folks in, because we need them in the pool
right.
to get what you want to have happen.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steinman Hayward, if I may, from kind of a technical standpoint, because I think it's important to keep that in mind as well. So, when actuaries set rates, they rely a lot on data as much as they can. And of course, I think we're all aware that there isn't as much data as we'd like going into 2014. So there are some areas where actuaries are making educated estimates, projections of some of the impacts of things like the uninsured. We have a little more information about OMIT because we had that data, but the uninsured is a place where there are some estimates being made. So that will be true for 2014, and it will also be true for 2015, because by the time carriers come to file with us again next year, they won't have had a chance to see.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So they won't have seen that come through. They're likely going to be relying on similar assumptions, maybe some competitive analysis, but also, you know, maybe some information about their enrollment. If they, you know, they should have some information about that as well. And I think that the idea is that, you know, as we were talking before, getting kind of broader access, getting everybody in the pool, that should be spreading the risk across a larger number of people, moderating the average premiums, and then by having the policies that are focused on preventive care and primary care, that the concept is that would help drive down future costs. But again, you know, I think it's going to be one of the things we wait to see come through the data in future years when we evaluate rate changes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. Tobacco is up there as a rating factor. Are they contemplating obesity as well?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, obesity is not a rating factor. Tobacco is a permissible rating factor in both the individual and small group markets.
Okay.
And then carriers...
So far.
Yeah. Carriers have always said that the mandates, you know, are a reason for increased premiums, but with our essential benefit package, I know I'm going back, but do most of our mandates go away, or are most of them in the essential benefit package?
Madam Chair, the essential benefit package that was adopted in Oregon includes the mandates for the two respective domains, individual and small group. So the state did not lose in the coverage for the essential benefit package anything that was mandated in either of those two markets. And there is some difference between what's mandated in a small group market and what's mandated in the individual. So those, now I would point out, and there is a federal requirement that if the state were to pass a new mandate, and it was after January
2012.
I think it's 2012. Then that mandate would have to be paid for by the state. Now, I would tell you that the anticipation of CMS, and I believe it's in the statute, if it's not, it's in rule, is that they will reevaluate the essential health benefit package sometime in 2015 for a 2016 effective date. So more to come on that one.
Okay. Well, I know that we have a bill, the autism bill.
Yes.
And people are saying that it is already in our essential benefit package, so that is really not a new mandate. But that...
I'm not competent to address that.
All right. Thank you.
The catastrophic plan is...
Probably isn't it? Okay, it probably isn't. So
the catastrophic plan I indicated earlier is the one plan that falls outside the metallic tiers. It is available to persons who are under 30 years of age or who buy the coverage while they're still under the age of 30, and those who are exempt from the mandate due to financial hardship. It is intended to be basically what I would call a higher deductible, limited coverage. It covers all of the same essential health benefits. We're estimating that the deductible is around $6,500. So there's a large deductible that you have to go through, but there are three primary care visits required, and there are some preventive services that have no cost sharing. Again, this is for it is intended from a policy perspective to be a lower cost option for the young. We will have to wait and see exactly how this shakes out relative to the costs in Oregon and elsewhere. A person who wants to buy catastrophic coverage, for example, because of their age, can only buy that coverage through carriers who are operating in the exchange. That is, they have to go to Cover Oregon to get the catastrophic plan, and there are no tax subsidies for the catastrophic plan. So let's talk about... We've been talking about those aspects of ACA that will tend to increase costs. One of the huge aspects of ACA is the financial assistance with the cost of coverage. There are actually two aspects of that financial assistance. One is a refundable, advanceable premium credit for persons between 100% and 400% of the FPL. And then the other would be a cost-sharing subsidy for persons that are under 250% of the FPL. Both these subsidization programs are estimated for some person, some people in the individual market of lower income. We'll actually see a 23% decrease in the cost of individual market member out-of-pocket costs. And I'd like to clarify just that the first bullet applies, it's financial assistance with the help, financial assistance for premium. And the second bullet, cost-sharing subsidies, is financial assistance for deductibles, co-insurance, and cost-sharing. So these two can work in tandem based upon one's income. And I've got a couple of examples here about how the premium tax works. The first thing is that there's a cost of the age-adjusted second lowest cost silver exchange. So let's take the Marion County. At some point, people in Marion County will be able to go to the exchange online and be able to look and say, okay, what carriers are offering coverage in my service area? And there will be identified by Cover Oregon the second lowest cost silver exchange plan. So that becomes, if you will, a reference plan or a base plan against which tax credits operate. So then there, the second piece of this calculation is a maximum monthly premium that's based upon my income. And I've got a table that I'll show you that. So you take the first and you subtract the second, and the third equals the refundable advanceable premium tax that's paid to the carrier by Treasury. And that premium tax credit is available to me regardless of the plan that I buy. So if I buy a more expensive silver plan, of course, the value of that tax credit diminishes. I pay more out of pocket for the premium. If I buy a gold, I'm going to pay a lot more. But I can also take that same premium, that same tax credit, and buy a bronze plan. So there, but the second lowest silver is used as a benchmark or a reference plan to, if you will, control the tax credit. So I got a couple examples. I'm just very quickly. If you look at the yellow the row 250 under federal statute or federal regulation, the maximum premium for somebody at 250% of the poverty level is 8.05% of their income. And this is old. This is not 2013 or 2014. This comes from the congressional research, but you get the idea that for a single person. These regulations say that the maximum I would pay in the exchange would be $183. So then let's go over and you look, if the silver reference plan was $400, the maximum premium I just showed you was my maximum contribution is $183, so I get a tax credit of $217, and of course I would pay the $183. If I pick a more expensive plan, and this the box to the right shows, let's say it's an alternative silver, it could be a gold, whatever, and it's $435, you apply the same tax credit of $217, and then, of course, the amount of my monthly premium increases by that additional amount.
But I have a question. So an individual, though, or a family, say this family, would have to pay $400 a month and would not get their premium contribution until they file their taxes, or tell me how that works.
They will apply for coverage. They will be granted. The exchange will be linked to the IRS, and the IRS, and through the calculations, will say Barney is eligible based on the filing information and verification of that filing information with the IRS. Barney is available for a tax credit of $217. I will know that the day I sign what my tax credit is, and I will pay the $183. I will be billed by the carrier $183, and the carrier will be paid by IRS directly the $217. So that's why they use the term, Madam Chair, of advanceable. It is paid in advance of your filing.
Wow. So
the technical stuff that's happening behind the scenes is,
well,
we'll see if it's remarkable. It's got to be remarkable to work.
Okay, so it's is there cross-checking to make sure that the information they are providing is...
That's the connection with the IRS.
Isn't that, and so it's based on your previous year's salary? Wages or income?
Madam Chair, and I won't speak for Cover Oregon on this, but I believe there is, the reason it's advanceable and refundable, I think there is also a link to when you file your taxes for the end of the year in terms of truing that up.
Things are squared up.
Yeah.
Because people's income will change.
Oh, sure.
So they're, you know, it just as their eligibility for Medicaid changes. So, and I don't have all of the nuances of how that's going to work, but... there are people who are exempt from the mandate, those of a religious, that have a religious belief. There are some organizations that their religious belief does not square with the ACA. Undocumented immigrants, the incarcerated already have, if you will, full coverage. Members of an Indian tribe, family incomes that are below the threshold for filing taxes, and generally that's an individual with income of less than $10,000 or $20,000 for a family, and that changes every year based upon IRS regulations. And the last one would be if you have to pay more than 8% of your income for health insurance after your employer contribution. So there are some exemptions.
Are they exempt or ineligible?
Those who have to pay 8% or more are exempt.
I'm talking about the whole list. Like undocumented.
They are ineligible to use the exchange.
Okay.
Well, if I understand the question correctly, some of them are ineligible and some of them are exempt.
Well, let's talk about, okay, the individual mandate does not apply to undocumented.
Okay, but a member of an Indian tribe could participate,
it's voluntary.
But doesn't have to.
It is voluntary, yes.
Okay, so there is a mixture in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And a person whose income is below the threshold can, in fact, apply and get the subsidies. But that doesn't. But if they don't want to use the exchange, they are exempt from any penalties.
Okay. We had done something a few years ago for those incarcerated to kind of speed up their eligibility upon release. Does that factor into this as well?
Eligibility for, Madam Chair,
Medicaid.
I think we've done some of that, and if you'd hold that question for tomorrow for Bruce, I think that there's been some work to actually, and it continues to.
Well, actually, we did the work. I'm just wondering if it still is going to apply.
I believe it does.
Okay.
I believe it does.
Okay.
Coverage that satisfies the mandate, of course, Medicare. Medicaid or CHIP, Children's Health Insurance, TRICARE, for those that are service members, retirees, or families that are covered by TRICARE. If one is enrolled in the Veterans Health Program, employer-sponsored coverage, which includes grandfathered plans, and if you purchase coverage and at least have a bronze-level actuarial value, then you have satisfied the mandate.
And Barney, I would also add that I think the self-purchase also applies to someone under 30 buying a catastrophic plan as well.
Right. penalties for not having health coverage for 2014. This is the greater the penalty is the. If let's just keep this simple for an adult. Let's say I'm an adult.
It's a scratch.
It's $95 for a single person. Or 1% of my family income, whichever the greater of that. And it, you can see, ratchets up for families, up to $285 for a family, or again, greater than 1%. A fair degree of controversy, it may be controversy. There's been a lot of debate, is the penalty substantial enough to actually encourage people who don't have coverage to buy coverage? And again, particularly the young. You can see, and I think this is moving in the right direction, that by 2016, it's up to 2.5% of family income. But again, there is concern that the strength of the mandate relative to actually the requirement to purchase.
It's $325 or $95, whatever, per month or per year?
Per year.
Yeah, you're better off just paying the penalty.
Yeah,
well, remember, 1%, so if you're making $20,000 a year, 1% is $200.
Right.
So it's the greater of that. But even 1% of income at, you know, if you're making 25,250 relative, I actually did some of this playing around of looking at, and I don't have coverage, and here's what coverage might cost. It gets meaningful, I think, in year three, but I think we're actually going to have to see how the combination of the mandate and the penalties work with the requirements of open enrollment, because on the exchange, you're not just going to be able, after the year one, to be able to go to the exchange as an individual and buy anytime you want. You're going to have to, unless you have a qualifying event, you're going to have to buy during a regular open enrollment. That helps address the issue of buying coverage, getting a surgery, dropping coverage, waiting for the next time, et cetera. The open enrollments will help mitigate against that kind of risk. But more to be watched on that front.
Is the penalty tied to their income tax as well?
Yes, that's how the penalty is collected.
Okay.
Implications. Most of you have probably heard of the Wakely report. It was commissioned by the insurance division, the health authority, and others have used it. It was a look at the ACA to try to get an understanding of what is the impact. It was delivered to us, to the insurance division, in July of 2012. So the first thing I would say about Wakely, I think it was a profoundly good piece of work, difficult work, with incomplete information. So it was the best we could get at the time. I've got a couple of arrows here. The bottom arrow, I think, is the one that many people have heard the most about.
That's right.
Is that the best estimate for the impact on individual premiums is a plus 38%. The other two arrows point to two of the major drivers. The 22% is what's known in Wakely as the merger of the subgroup of the submarkets, and what that means in layman's language is bringing OMIP, the federal FMIP, federal high-risk pool, children's reinsurance, and portability coverage into the individual market. Portability, for background, is coverage that's required in Oregon for employers that are not subject to the COBRA requirements, so an individual can buy a portability coverage if they lose their coverage. All of those populations, of course, tend to have a higher profile of medical use and therefore cost. And then the 15% is the morbidity change of just the new uninsured coming in, the non-OMIP, FMIP children's. There's been, since this report, and probably even during the report, Laura may have, there's been a lot of debate about, is it 15%? Some nationally have written that it could actually be less than 15%. In a few weeks, in a few days, really, we'll have a better idea of how Oregon carriers have looked at this. I would note, and just I wanted to point out from important information, we'll see the line, the row there that says age slope limited to 3 to 1. It has zero impact on the total pool, but it has impact on individuals in that pool based upon. Mm-hmm. So this does not address the changes that could come about, the 3 to 1.
So where...
Did I say that correctly?
You did.
Okay.
So where is, you know, the carriers are telling me about all of these fees that they have to pay to everybody. Where is that in
that's
there?
That's in addition. Well, the provider fee, you can see the provider, the 1% provider fee is there. The PCORI...
Madam Chair, I believe that are a few other fees, and I think we'll talk about some of them when we get to the reinsurance bill as well. But so there are reinsurance fees. I'm not sure that they are built into the net impact of the reinsurance program that's shown here.
Okay.
And sir, I don't think the patient-centered outcomes research fee is.
I would also note that you'll see that the federal reinsurance program is on the row that says reinsurance program shows a minus 8. That is actually now estimated to be minus 11, and the reason is that when Wakely put this report together, the total what was in the public domain as far as how the federal reinsurance program would work was not fully known. So this has actually been updated. So you could, with that update by itself, that 8 is 11, so 38 you could argue now is 35. We'll get a little bit more into that when we get into
or 52.
Or 52, if, depending upon your carrier. This again is from the Wakely report. It's just to point out that for those in income levels 138 and up to 250, the impact of the premium tax credits will have a substantial impact on the cost of coverage. And this table does not reflect what the cost-sharing subsidies would be for an individual, particularly below 250. But for those between, let's say, 150 and 200%, the cost-sharing subsidies will lower the cost of coverage, total coverage, even more. Now we're getting into mitigation programs. Those are three programs in the federal act that are intended to moderate for two of them for a period of time the increased costs, and one permanently to better spread those costs based upon the underlying risk that a carrier receives. Very quickly, the reinsurance program is a federal program. It's 3 years, runs for 2014, 15, and 16. A risk corridor program basically moves money from carriers that do better than expected to move some money from them to carriers who do less than expected on a medical loss ratio. And risk adjustment is a permanent program that actually will, for carriers that over time have higher profile risk patients, will actually see premium increases. Those that have lower risk populations will help pay for that. I'm going to go through this. You can see the federal reinsurance is 525 because I want to get Laura to the Senate bill, House Bill 3428. The risk corridor program, again, you can see that moves money between, if you will. It's really the risk corridor is to help actuaries in these first few years is to try to take some of the risk and guessing out of where they set their prices. And then the risk adjustment program, I think, is probably the federal Medicare program has this. Medicare Advantage has it. But it's a permanent program that will redistribute premiums. Plans with higher than average health needs will see a positive premium adjustment, and it will be paid for by plans with enroll lower. When I was the deputy director of the Washington HCA, we used risk adjustment in our PEB program for the insured population and used it very successfully. It's a fairer way to really address carriers who consciously or unconsciously attract high risk, let's say a lot of diabetics, and they manage them very well. They're not penalized they're less penalized for that kind of behavior. They're actually rewarded to take folks with higher risks and manage them well.
And Barney, if I may, another reason why risk adjustment is really important is one of the kind of basic principles behind the rating reforms is that carriers can't reflect the risk of their book of business in their pricing. They have to assume that they're getting a market average risk. And so, you know, there's this push that you shouldn't be saying, well, I have a less healthy book, so I'm going to charge more for my coverage. You know, these are all in place to really encourage that I'm pricing for a market average risk. Risk adjustment and the other programs are in place to help carriers realize that more of a market average outcome when each of their calendar years is completed.
So, two bills that are pending in this session, and with that, I'll run the slides.
Thank you, Barney. Madam Chair, members of the committee. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a couple of bills that that we have currently pending in the legislature. You may be familiar with them already. And the first one I'll talk about is House Bill 3458. And this is a state reinsurance program. And Barney already talked a little bit about the federal reinsurance program that exists. And just to give a little more detail on the federal program to put the state in context. So the federal program has an assessment that is levied against all providers of commercial coverage. So that's small group, large group, individual, but it also gets at self-funded plans through the third-party administrators that that administer those plans. And that funding is used to pay a portion of claims in the individual market. So it's really targeting, again, kind of the high-risk, large claim dollars that might be driving some of that 22% impact of the submarket merger that Barney referred to before. So trying to help address those new entrants to the market that might be driving claims costs up for the market as a whole. So the federal program, it's 3 years, and it pays in the first year 80% of claims for a given member between $60,000 and $250,000 in the first year. And that's expected to have an impact on average about 11% of claims. So it's still not getting at quite half of the impact of just that merger alone. And so there was a decision that we really needed to look at doing something more to help the individual market, to stabilize that, to ensure that we're attracting people to participate in the market as broadly as possible and stabilize premiums in the long term. And so we the insurance division, also with the assistance of Cover Oregon and also the governor's office, OHA, we led a technical advisory group where we worked with actuaries from our major carriers and talked to them about just kind of setting the policy piece of it aside, did the numbers pan out? If we look at the current assessments that exist in the market today to pay for things like OMIP, Healthy Kids Connect, through the 1% premium tax, and also carriers that subsidize their portability business, if we took that amount of funding, could that be used for a state reinsurance program to also help kind of smooth that transition into the post-ACA world? And so what we came up with was that, yes, you know, we actually could do something meaningful with some of that that assessment money. So what, but there were a couple of ways that we, it was very important that we structured this in a way that made sense and that kind of mirrored the federal program as well. So it's a three-year program like the federal program, so it only lasts through 2014, and it also steps down. So it does kind of come to more of a steady state after the third year, so there's not kind of a cliff, if you will, after the first year or the second year.
Now explain this again. You said that the Accountable Care Act will pay for 3 years, 90% or 80% or whatever it is that you said.
Madam Chair, yes. So the federal program pays for the first year 80% of claims between $60,000 and $250,000 for a member during a given year.
So wouldn't that save the state money because we're paying it now?
So, Madam Chair, yes. So that's already figured into the numbers,
right?
And that accrues to the entire, you know, basically the entire individual market population. And so we already took into consideration that the federal assessment is 5.25 per member per month. And we said, well, let's kind of remove that from the equation of how much assessment dollars we have left to kind of think about working with. And we, and actually on the next slide kind of shows at least the assessment piece of it, but you know, we have in total, that bar on the left is about $11.50 or so in total assessment dollars on average. And we already know we've got that federal piece, the 525, that is done and will be collected, and we have no say in that. And so we really wanted to work kind of, you know, between that 525 and the top of that bar. So we had about a $6 range to move in. But we looked at, on top of what the feds are going to pay, is there a state program that could wrap around the federal program, augment those funds, and help smooth out the premium increases in the individual market? So the state program is going to make use of the federal funds, we are going to make use of the federal funds already through our regular market mechanisms, and then our state program will kind of drop down below it. It will fit around the side and also come up on top. And the way that's going to work is that in the first year, the state program would pay 90% of the claims between $30,000 and $60,000. It'll pay 10% between $60,000 and $250,000. So it'll take that federal payment and bring it up to 90% in total. And then it'll also, the state program will also pay 90% between $250,000 and $300,000. And the catch with this, though, is that the state program is more focused, and it's more focused on those higher-risk populations that are expected to drive more of the increases in the individual market. So it this additional state reinsurance program applies to the OMIP population, FMIP population, and children's reinsurance and portability plan members who are enrolled in those plans as of the end of 2013.
So another way to think of this is the federal program is available to insurers who incur high claims costs for anybody that comes into the individual pool in 2014, 15, 16. The state program in Oregon is specifically targeted only those individuals in the pool that come from OMIP, FMIP, Children's Reinsurance and Portability. And we know just based upon our knowledge of those four programs that those are higher claims costs. So it helps supplement, it helps reduce those costs in the short
term. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Laura, I just want to make sure that I understand this. So we're going to charge the 4% to everybody in the individual market to cover those four groups that are going to have excessive claims?
Madam Chair, Senator Knope, so what we propose to do is charge $4 per member per month, so it should be coming out to less than 4%, but it is $4 per member per month, and it's assessed on small group, large group, individual, as well as reinsurers of self-insured plans. So it's the same assessment base that pays the OMIP assessment today. So it is broad, and then it pays, as you stated, for the claims arising from those high-risk members that are coming into the individual market.
And just to reiterate, the federal program is estimated to lower claims costs by 11%. This is estimated to lower it on average another 4%.
But the federal assessment is on all of those plus
the self-insured.
Plus the self-insured.
Right.
So that's a bigger pot of money to start with.
Yeah, and it's a national program.
Yeah.
It is.
Initially, when we were doing the work, all of us, Insurance Division, Cover Oregon, Health Authority, et cetera, originally thought that the federal reinsurance program would be somewhat state-specific. That is, we knew what the assessment that would be gathered from Oregon employers would be and that that assessment would be used in Oregon. When the final rules came out, we're actually somewhat surprised that it's not a state-specific, that they're going to assess all of the employers, let's just say all of the Oregon employers, but it's not all going to stay in Oregon. That will go into a national pool, and it will pay claims pursuant to the federal requirements, but there actually could be some states that are net exporters of assessments and states that are net importers based upon
and
the medical loss ratios of the populations.
And we'll be able to make that determination over time, won't we?
Well, we will be able to follow that closely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, please. So that's really interesting.
And that has the potential to be really good for Oregon or really bad for
really
Oregon,
bad.
Right?
Yeah.
Because by having a larger pool for the federal reinsurance, which is basically what you're doing by saying that it goes into one big national pool and then goes back out again. It's basically taking all the covered lives in the entire United States and putting that into your entire pool, right? So the bigger the pool, in theory, the lower the cost per member, in theory, right?
Well, this is an assessment program, not an insurance program.
Right.
So the assessment is where they get the revenue. So it's $5.25 PM. So
it's
that brings.
I misunderstood.
Yeah. So
I
the national pool that's created is on the revenue side. The expense side, however, is more localized.
Right.
It's at the state level.
So if a state has more covered lives in their exchange, that's where the per member assessment.
The per member assessment, the 525, is independent of the exchange. It's a federal.
It's everybody.
Commercial and insurance, not government sponsored insurance. Doesn't have government sponsored insurance.
It's anybody that's insured or covered through a self insured policy.
So for all of us in PEB.
Correct.
For any of the
individual markets, small group market, for large national, international, or local companies who are self-insured, they pay the same thing. The headlines read $63, per employer, everyone will pay.
Right.
And that funds this program. The 525, now just point out both programs, that the assessment goes down. The 525 declines in year two.
And it gets down to about two bucks. Lower percentage. I mean, the feds pick up 100% of our new
OHP enrollees for the first
2 years.
2 years, and then it tails off to 90% over a period of time, which is one of the reasons why, in theory, the assessment would go down.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Hayward, this actually this is separate from that, and so this goes down and is actually set out in statute that it's an aggregate amount that's collected nationwide. It steps down from, I think, $10 billion in the first year, and it drops to six, I think, in the second year, and then four in the third year, and then they allocate that out. So it's designed to kind of phase out. And I did want to address, if I may, your earlier question about kind of this, the disadvantages and the advantages of this being national. So it, you know, as Barney was saying, it doesn't pool the risk. And there have been arguments made on both sides as to whether Oregon will benefit or not from this. And the argument that we might benefit comes from the fact that we have a pretty strong high-risk pool. So there's a thought that with having a lot of covered members in the high-risk pool, those individuals will go into the individual market and basically be covered by that reinsurance program as compared to some other states that don't have as robust a pool. But there's also the concept that other states who have higher claims costs on average would benefit. So it kind of depends on, relatively speaking, how many people we get in the market, in the individual market specifically, and how claims costs compare here versus other states.
Okay, I apologize. You just confused me further.
I'm sorry.
Okay, I was trying to track what you were saying, but I thought that what we were talking about originally with this pooled thing was exactly what you just said, which was the pool of money basically to help cover excess claims. But then it sounded as if I was wrong, and it was the assessment per member per month to cover the Medicaid lives that were the people who were coming onto OHP. And I thought that's what we were talking about.
$5.25 assessment is for the federal reinsurance pool.
That's what I thought I said. Okay. And then you said, no, I was wrong. It was for the...
Well, Madam Chair, Senator...
I'm sorry. I was confused.
You were mixing the revenue program with the claims experience issues. There's an expense side and a revenue side. So there will be a pool created nationally on the $5.25. What we get as a state is independent of what that pool has in revenue. It is a function of how much it's really is driven by two things. What's the risk in the pool of the morbidity, and also what's the claims cost? And so a state that has 20% higher claims costs for the same service will in fact benefit more than a state that has, for the same service, a lower claims cost.
So is this another example of Oregon having a geographic disparity yet again?
Potentially.
Possibly. And Barney, if I may, I just want to kind of clarify a little bit. So, I mean, there's kind of risk on both sides. There's like an aggregate pool of money, and, you know, that's that $10 billion that's expected to be collected. And they've converted that into this per member per month assessment. So hopefully they're going to collect $10 billion. That's the plan. So there's kind of, they have to be able to collect that aggregate funding. That funding is then translated into a statement to states that, okay, the federal government will pay for all states kind of a fixed percentage between 60 and 250, and that applies to all states. Now, if they don't collect enough, or they find that the demand for payments from states is greater than what they collected, on a national basis, they're going to say, well, we said we were going to pay 80%, but it turns out we can only pay 60% and drop that down. So there are kind of some, there is kind of this pooling of claims on a national basis, but there's nothing pooled to kind of from a like, let's bring it all together and we're all sharing in the cost together in that sense. It's not really kind of being priced that same way.
I think it's 4:30 in the afternoon and it's dark in here and I'm not tracking as well as I should. So how about if we have a separate conversation about this offline, because I don't want to take up too much of your time, because I'm getting more confused.
And we do have just about 20 minutes.
Well, that's very similar to what happened with Medicare and Medicaid when they said, oops, we can't pay this, but you can figure it out. That's what they did. So anyway,
go ahead.
Senator, happy to fill you in later.
Do you want to talk about that one? So
kind of moving on, we were talking a little bit about the fees, and actually, Madam Chair, you had asked earlier about some of the other fees that carriers have referenced that they will have to pay for. So I mentioned that right now there's about a little shy of $11.50 on average per member per month in assessments or cross-subsidization that carriers pass through into their premiums. And we had said that we, you know, in kind of formulating how this state program would work, that we wanted the combined assessment for the federal and the state to kind of fit within that so that we weren't introducing more fees on top of that. And when we looked at the numbers, we actually came out with a total assessment that was less, so 925 versus the 1144. But we wanted to be clear that in addition to the reinsurance fees, there are some other fees and rather sizable ones that are now imposed as a result of the federal law. And so these are not state fees. But the big one that you see, if you look at the graph, we have the current level, the 2013 is on the left, and then I have two bars on the right. And that's showing a range. And on the left side, we have kind of a low estimate. And the reason there's a low estimate there is the insurer's fee, the kind of big, kind of pale peach-colored box, could range anywhere from about $660 per member per month to about $9. And it ranges based on the tax status of the carrier and, you know, the size of their book. And you know, it's a percentage, so it's not always a fixed per member per month assessment. But it's widely variable, and it's quite large. It's larger than the federal assessment. And so you add that on top. There's also and that fee is to fund the expansion of Medicaid. Just to be clear, that is what that fee is for.
That's that fee.
Yeah. So that's the $660 to $9. And you'll hear that referred to as like the ACA fee or the insurer's fee. And that is something that wasn't explicitly included in the table Barney showed earlier from the Wakely report, but they did provide an estimate of it elsewhere in their report, and it will be reflected in carriers' rate filings.
Okay.
So, yeah, you should expect to see that in their filings. And then the little...
Senator Canope.
And that's mandated by ACA?
Madam Chair, Senator Canope, yes, that is a required fee, and it's assessed against all insurance companies based on the premiums that they write in 2013.
Senator Canope, that's how the feds can say, you do the expansion, we'll pay for it, but we're going to tax you to pay for it, is basically mm-hmm. how that works.
Mm-hmm. There are some alleviations for not-for-profit insurers. The first few hundred million in claims or in premiums is exempt, and so it varies by the legal, as mm-hmm. Laura said, it varies by the legal mm-hmm. status, mm-hmm. and therefore one of the reasons it's hard to get an average is looking at the impact on each company. Mm-hmm. We'll have a better idea when we see the rate filings later this month about how each carrier and their legal organization assesses the impact of this.
Follow-up question. So if you are a state that doesn't opt in, you don't have to pay that?
Madam Chair, Senator Canope, this is levied by the federal government on all carriers, regardless of whether the state is in the, mm-hmm. whether the state is actively in the exchange or whether the state is expanding its Medicaid program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, one of the reasons why more and more states are actually opting in. That's
right. And I'll quickly just speak. There was one additional assessment on there that I should mention. Sorry, Barney.
Yes.
And so the last part of the bar at the top, there's a dollar per member per month, and it's labeled as the PCOR fee, and that's the patient-centered outcomes research fee. And so that's to fund research into comparative effectiveness and focusing on better outcomes for patients. And so that's I believe that's already been implemented, but that will continue to also show up in rate filings.
Is that funding a grant program, basically, or?
It Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, it goes to a new, I'm not certain it's a federal agency. I believe it is I think it's constructed as a kind of a public corporation. But it is to do work not unlike the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at OHSU does, or to commission work like that. I would characterize it as the 21st century version of the Health Resources Commission that Oregon put in place 25 years ago. That is, it's to look at technology, it's to look at best practices relative to clinical innovation and to move them out. I would say one of the interesting advantages, the Northwest, we have a member from Oregon on the, it's called PCORI. It's called an institute, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. Carrie Barnett, from Regents is a board member of PCORI, and Washington State has a member from, on the board who's been involved in technology in a review in Washington State. So it's about a 20-person board, but we are well represented, in part because both these states have looked in this policy area for a number of years.
And actually, one of my colleagues at OHSU just got one of the first two really big PCORI grants, Dr. Jennifer DeVoe, through, and it's, I mean, you know, upwards of $1.5 million or something large like that. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing a lot of this research locally, I would expect.
All right. Well, I'll kind of wrap up on state reinsurance if there are no more questions for the time being, and move quickly to House Bill 2240. Probably not as exciting as 3458, but House Bill 2240 is really an ACA alignment bill, and so there are a number of areas, and many of them Barney touched on already, in federal law where state law had conflicted. There were things such as, you know, allowable rating factors. You know, we didn't have anything in law to kind of restrict the rating, the age rating. We have various requirements to offer portability coverage. Portability goes away at the end of the year because because underwriting goes away in 2014. So there's no need for a portability. Similar with OMIP, which I believe is actually part of our 3458 bill. Is that correct, Barney? The abolishment of...
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to mix that up, but OMIP is also kind of removed through House Bill 3458, but kind of the same idea there, that with no medical underwriting, there's no need to continue those two programs separately. And there are a number of other provisions in there that allow the state to define essential health benefits, a definition of pre-existing conditions so that it's clear that carriers can't deny coverage due to pre-existing conditions. And there are another kind of just a number of cleanup items there that I won't go through in great detail unless there are any specific questions. But it's really not meant to kind of augment what the ACA already does, but just to make sure that we're in alignment and that we don't have any statutes that conflict. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
And they're both in Ways and Means.
That is my understanding. I think they're still there, correct? Or in a subcommittee?
Yes. Right? And Madam Chair, there are the two bills that we referenced are in Ways and Means, and the two bills that you'll hear tomorrow relating to Medicaid are also in Ways and Means. And Bruce and others will elaborate on those tomorrow in their testimony.
We already had our first public hearing on the ACA alignment, on the ACA alignment one. Did we? I can't remember. We've had a couple of public hearings on related bills.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I believe that those two public hearings were held through the Ways and Means Subcommittee.
What I'm saying.
Oh, yes.
I'm on that subcommittee.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you were referring
full.
To here. Sorry.
No. I'm saying that I think we already started to hear those bills in sub last week.
Okay.
Or something like that.
I really want to get through the last six pages.
And I'll go very quickly, Madam Chair. Small group. The first thing is, how is the small group defined under ACA? States have the option under ACA, and we took the option to define small group in Oregon as employer groups under 50. That fits with our current definition of small group. However, in 2016, under the federal requirement, the definition of small group will be increased to those mm-hmm. that are under 100. So in 2014, 2015, the Cover Oregon small group or shop exchange will be available to those that are under 50. In 2017, under the ACA federal statute, states can then decide through legislative action in concurrence with their governors to expand the exchange to groups over 100. Those are independent decisions that each state will arrive at on their own. I want to point out that purchasing through the exchange is optional for small business, but if they do buy a product through the exchange, it is the only buying a product through the exchange qualifies the employer to receive a tax credit. There are small employer tax credits in place today that went in place for 2011-2012. The tax credit it's up to 50% of the employer's payment for premium so long as the employer pays at least 50% of the total cost, and it's targeted at small employers with 25 or less employees and with annual average wages for the employer of under $50,000. And it, so, see,
the employer or employee?
It's the average wage for all the employees.
Okay, you said employer.
Excuse me. The average wage for all employees in the entity is $50,000 or less. So if you're very small with a very, with say $25,000 average wage, the tax credit is higher than, is high, and then it tails off as you, either your wage average wage increases or your size of your employer increases. The requirements that I covered under the individual market relative to the essential health benefits, the minimum actuarial values, the bronze, silver, gold, platinum, the prohibition of annual limits, the limits on cost sharing, and the rating rules, the adjusted community rating, for example, for 3-1, elimination of underwriting factor. All of these, many of these requirements that I already went through are also applicable in the small group market. I think it's important to carry away that these new requirements are applicable in the small group market, whether the product is sold through the exchange or is not sold through the exchange. So there will be a standardization, as there is in the individual market, in the small group market for all of these requirements, regardless of whether the employer buys through the exchange or not.
Barney, will we still be able to differentiate between full-time employees and part-time employees, that sort of thing?
I'll have to get back to you.
Okay. Well, that's...
And I know part of the issue about counting, about whether you're a small employer or not, there are a set of regulations that have to do with how you count your seasonal employees, how you count.
Right, and that's.
But I believe that the require. Well, I'm getting on thin ice, but I know there are minimum. There are some minimum contribution requirements. But let me get back to you about how.
Okay.
What you're really asking, does an employer have some options to give some contributions to part-time that are different or to exclude them altogether?
Yeah, actually, I mean, especially if you get into agriculture where you have a
right.
steady workforce and then you have
right.
seasonal people, and I mean,
right.
that could be rather significant.
Right. Yeah, it is. I'll get more information to you on that. This is a similar chart that I showed you earlier on individual. I think the important takeaway is the best estimate from Wakely, the bottom arrow, is that on average about a 4% increase, but you can see the low from minus 5 to a plus 16. I want to point out, and again, I'd like Laura's professional interpretation. I think another important takeaway is the age slope requirements that I talked about in individual do apply in small groups. So this issue about, on average, in the small group pool, that age gender slope row, which shows 0, 0, 0, but then minus 10 to plus 50, really elucidates the difference that if you have a young workforce, you're liable to see more increases in your premium related to the change in the age band than if you have an older workforce. Is that a fair generalization?
It is.
Because right now, the small group requirement for age bands is not required at 3-1. It can vary differently than 3-1. So small groups will see some changes in premium related to that move to the 3-1. I'd like to point out that, because I know time is of the essence, one of these policy areas that the industry, that I think those of us in state government have been concerned about from day one, has been this move to a 3-1 age slope on a given date. From a policy perspective, there would have been a better way to do this, and we actually asked for permission, and that would be to phase in the move to 3-1 over a 3-year or 4-year or 5-year period so that it would be more gradual. And we actually put together informally, we've worked formally, I believe, the NAIC, the National Governors Association, states working independently with their congressional delegations, have all asked for that permission. Unfortunately, the ACA statute was written without a conference committee, by the way, was written in such a way that 3-to-1 is in the statute, and HHS said we have no way to alter that. So I wanted to point out that we've been concerned about this move and thought there were better ways to do it. But
it's a disincentive for young people on the front end.
Well, it also creates, if you will, what I call cliffs as opposed to slopes, which make actuaries really nervous and have impact in costs really soon, as opposed to, okay?
Put a factor in human behavior somewhere there, don't we?
Again, I've talked about the tax credit, and actually there is now, and there will be in the Cover Oregon, a website where employers can go in and put in information about their employees, their average wages, and find out, get an estimate of the tax credit. One of the issues that I think is exciting for Oregon and for Cover Oregon, through Cover Oregon, is there will be a whole new range of choice for small employers who go to the exchange. And I've put these four blocks up here. Is that the upper left hand, the traditional choice, today an employer decides I'm going to spend $330 and that can buy a plan. So he picks the plan, he picks the carrier, and the employer pays the $330. The box to the upper right-hand quarter, carrier choice, it's increasingly common now that you can go to carrier X. And with the $330 as a set or defined contribution, the employees can pick a range of coverages from that carrier of different actuarial values, and they would pay the difference. For example, so if I'm, and you can do this today with many of the dominant carriers. So if the employer pays $330, I could actually pick a platinum covered and pay $390, pay the difference of the $65. In the exchange, there are going to be two additional choices. The first one is the employer picks the $330 and say, the $330, I will pay $330 in the silver level plan, and then the individual members of that employee group can choose among the carriers in that silver tier, and they would pay more if it is more than $330. And then the last one, which is the most choice, and that is the rules of the exchange as currently written, is the employer defines the $330 and states its silver coverage, and the employees then can choose any product from any carrier so long it is no more than one step up from the tier that the employer picked, or one step down. So you can see there's going to be a lot of choice for the broad choice is very complex from both an operational and actuarial point of view. The metal tier choice will allow people in small groups to pick from an array of carriers, a Providence, a Kaiser, a Regents, et cetera.
Barney, what happens? Okay, I'm the employer and I say, I'm going to pay, and we'll go to the broad choice because it's there, I'm going to pay $330. And so the employee has lots of options. He chooses $300. What happens to my other $30?
That's an excellent question, and I'm not going to go on record that I know the answer to that. You're answering, yeah. Does the employee get the $30, or does the employee save it? And are you?
I'm not sure either.
You know, I
will get an answer to that.
The ability for the employee to buy up, I think, is wonderful.
Right.
But you know, if the employer is doing X and I can pocket some money here, and that might be right. Problematic.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, and I also don't know exactly, but it's quite possible that could be up to the employer to decide. Some sort of incentive. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But Cover Oregon may be in a better position to answer that.
We'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
The last thing, for those that are outside the small group area, this is, Madam Chair, I think my last slide of any import. There are pay or play provisions for employers generally in the country. So if you're larger than 30 employees, and that is defined, and there's a whole set of regulations on how you define that, but on average it's 30 plus hours a week. There is a penalty for it's called the free rider, that if an employer fits into that category and offers no coverage, and at least one employee receives a subsidy through the exchange, there is a penalty that the employer will pay. For those that employers that do offer coverage and their coverage is deemed to be unaffordable by one of two tests, one that the employee's cost is more than 9.5% of their household income, or the employer pays less than 60% of the cost, then there's another penalty, and there's actually it's a two-part that's the lesser of. And then last point is that there are grandfathered plans. That is, there are employer and individual plans that are were grandfathered, not subject to most of the ACA. Grandfathered plans are not exempt from the previous two requirements.
Could I back up? Okay. I'm an employer. I don't offer health care to my employees, but one of my employees goes in the exchange, then I have a penalty for all the rest of my employees. Is that what that is?
If you employ more than 50 people,
right,
and you do not provide coverage,
right,
and one of your employees uses the exchange,
yes,
to get coverage, you are subject to the penalty, and it is the $2,000 times the total number of employees minus 30. So if you had 50 employees, let's say you have 100 employees.
Yeah.
100 minus 30 is 70 times $2,000.
Well, I'll tell you what, that employee that went in the exchange just got fired.
God, you're
well,
bad.
If five or six of them go to the exchange, you're going to... But, I mean, that's... I'm here to explain.
I know.
Okay.
I know. I'm not sure the messenger.
Again, back to what Sean said at the beginning, this work that we've just touched on with you, and I appreciate your patience, really has been a collaboration across three major agencies. It's been quite remarkable, given my history around state government, around these issues, that the Insurance Division, the Health Authority, Cover Oregon, the Governor's Office, working very closely on, again, how do we make what the federal rules work for Oregon. And I guess one last comment that I would make, I think what's very important to watch over time in Cover Oregon will be the kinds of policies that are available that begin to incorporate the transformational aspects of the delivery system like we're trying to do in through the CCOs and Medicaid. And I think you will begin to see products like that that have substantial differences in cost. And that will begin to see a new market where both providers and plans are really trying to bring greater value. But I think 2014, you'll see a little bit of that. I'm predicting in 2015, 2016, there will be even more as the commercial market begins to adapt or adopt the kinds of principles behind the coordinated care model of care. So with that, Madam Chair, again, I appreciate the opportunity to, I hope this has been helpful.
Oh, it's been very helpful,
I am,
at least
I am
for
available
me.
For two more months at that website.
Okay.
If you have...
Then you're leaving us?
You're going to retire again?
Really. I have no job.
You've said that about five times.
I know, but it's garden, grass, grandkids.
Actually, I like that.
And Laura's available. So we're available as you see things at the committee or individual level, your individual office staff. If you have questions, please call upon us. We'll try to clarify where we can, or we'll try to find the people that do have the answers to your questions.
Well, thank you very much.
Good to see you.
For this presentation. It's been very valuable, I'm sure, to all of us. All right. With that, there's no further discussion. We'll see you all then on Thursday.
Part two.
Part two, yeah. And we're adjourned.